And they held up prefabricated signs saying you can't support failure, close Dyett High School. They got on the microphone and ranted incoherent statements. And so those were not the people that struggled for that school. And those will not be the people that lead Dyett's renaissance as Dyett Global Leadership at Green Technology High School.
G2 Brown, thanks so much for being with us. National Director of the Journey for Justice Alliance. He's in the 19th day of a hunger strike with other hunger strikers around Chicago public schools. That does it for our show. Special thanks to Julie Crosby, Steve Martinez, Miguel Noguera, and Mike DiFilippo. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Have you entered the KBOO Fall Membership Drive Sweepstakes? The grand prize is a trip to Busurias, Mexico, including $1,000 in airfare and a week's worth of lodging at Casa Tranquila. Other prizes include a Portland Center Stage Flex Pass, hundreds of dollars to Grand Central Bakery, and health and wellness packages at Evolution Healthcare and Fitness. We have raised over $10,000 at this time to help shorten the Fall Membership Drive. Remember, for every $15,000 we raise before September 9th, we will take one day off our fall membership drive. A donation is not required to enter the sweepstakes. For more info, visit kboo.fm/2015fallsweeps. And thank you to everyone who has donated early to the fall membership drive.
Tune into KBOO every weekday at 7 p.m. for Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective with Davey D. Hard Knock Radio features in-depth interviews and profiles with community leaders, activists, hip-hop artists, and musicians, giving voice to community concerns and offering a unique forum to explore issues relevant to hip-hop community. That's every weekday at 7 p.m. here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
This is KBOO Portland, listener-powered, non-corporate community radio.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Marion County is the latest Oregon county to declare a drought emergency as numerous wildfires continue to burn in different parts of the state.
A judge has ruled that Muslim Americans who were unjustly added to the no-fly list may not sue the FBI for damages.
A section of the Mississippi River near Kentucky has been closed following a spill of oil slurry from a barge.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, September 4th, 2015. I'm Martin.
And I'm Linda Olson Osterlund. Marion County, Oregon has declared a drought emergency. The action came during a special meeting of the Board of Commissioners, who are seeking assistance from the governor to allow local farmers to increase access to surface water for irrigation. If the governor declares a drought in Marion County, it will join 24 other Oregon counties already under similar declarations. Last week, the commissioners in Marion County received a request from local blueberry farmers to declare a county drought emergency. The request comes as the farmers seek temporary water use permits to use water destined for households and divert it for irrigation. Newly planned blueberry crops are being particularly affected by the drought. But only the governor has the power to exercise emergency water rights authority and to grant local farmers access to the water, which is currently allocated for household use.
A Portland jury today awarded a Reynolds School District student $800,000 after he fell down at school. The injury will result in the child never walking again. Foster Smith, who was 10 years old at the time of the fall, suffers from muscular dystrophy. A teacher's assistant was supposed to accompany him whenever he had to walk somewhere at school. But because of cost-cutting measures at the school, the child was only accompanied by the assistant for about 30 minutes each day. After his injury at school, Foster went through 8 weeks of intense physical therapy, but he was not able to stand and walk any distance. Now, Foster will have to use a wheelchair for the rest of his life. Despite a jury ruling that the child should receive $800,000, state law puts a cap at $600,000, and attorney fees will further cut into the amount he will receive. Most of the money will go toward covering Foster's long-time medical care.
As of last night, around 750,000 acres of forest in Oregon and Washington have been burned by wildfires this year. In just one day, yesterday, 75,000 acres were burned. State officials have warned thousands of residents of Northern Oregon to leave their homes because of fire danger. The Grizzly Bear Complex on the Oregon-Washington line currently has a dozen small fires burning, with over 12,000 acres already burned. The National Guard is now on site to begin fighting the fires, which are expected to worsen with this weekend's weather forecast of gusty winds. Also, in an unprecedented move, Washington officials asked citizens to help with digging fire lines if adequate instructions can be provided from firefighters. 3,000 volunteers have responded to the call. In Oregon, campfire bans remain in effect throughout the state.
Judge Vance Day, former chairman of the Oregon Republican Party and now a Marion County Circuit Court judge in Salem, took steps Thursday to create a legal defense fund in an apparent response to his decision not to perform same-sex marriage ceremonies. Inquiries into Day's performance are being made by the Oregon Commission on Judicial Fitness and Disability and involve allegations of violations of the Oregon Code of Judicial Conduct and the Oregon Constitution. In Ashland, Kentucky, meanwhile, a federal judge ordered Rowan County Clerk Kim Davis to jail for contempt Thursday after she refused to follow court orders to issue marriage licenses to gay couples. She also refused an offer to resign from her job with full benefits. So Davis was brought to court where a judge ruled that as a clerk of the state, she was required to comply with the law, and refusing to issue marriage licenses to same-sex couples was a direct violation of the law.
A Hillsboro woman has filed a $2.5 million lawsuit against Oregon State University, saying she was raped while a freshman at the university in 1999. The lawsuit names both the school and its former head football coach, Mike Riley, who now coaches the University of Nebraska football team. The school failed to take action, the woman says, when she reported being raped by the cousin of an OSU football player. She says the football player secretly laced her beer with a date rape drug. The incident took place in an apartment complex where members of the Beavers football team lived. She further alleges that sexual assault counselor at the school's health center blamed her for the incident when she reported the rape. She was encouraged recently to take action when she saw an article in 2014 about a woman who reported being raped at the same apartment building in 1998. The plaintiff alleges in her lawsuit that the university has taken no action to remedy a culture of sexual violence that centers around the football team. She says this culture of sexual violence contributed to her attack.
Is a starfish, or a sea star as it's also called, the latest creature on the growing list of possible victims of climate change? The ultimate cause hasn't been determined yet, but what has been determined is that these sea creatures are dying from something called sea star wasting syndrome. There are several dozens of sea star species on the West Coast, invertebrates that come in a brilliant array of colors. Wasting syndrome is caused by a virus, one that has an increased presence when sea waters become warmer, as they have been along the West Coast. The number of sea stars has plummeted since the disease was first spotted on a Washington beach at Olympia National Park more than 2 years ago. The disease has since been spotted in 20 species of sea star. So far, wasting syndrome has not been spotted in other marine animals.
The United States Coast Guard has reported that 250,000 gallons of oil slurry could have been spilled into the Mississippi River following a towboat collision near Columbus, Kentucky. The Coast Guard says the spill occurred at roughly 8 p.m. Wednesday when a boat crash caused a cargo tank on a barge to rupture. That resulted in a spill of some of the refinery byproduct being carried on the barge. A section of the river is now closed, and the Coast Guard stated that an aerial assessment spotted, quote, a 5-mile discoloration, end quote, starting at the site of the accident. In response, the Kentucky Waterways Alliance said that such spills are inevitable unless we choose to move from a fossil fuel economy to one based on an alternative, sustainable energy. According to the Alliance, despite industry claims about the safety of the various methods of transporting fossil fuels, the reality is that none of it is safe. As long as we are using oil, coal, and gas, the group says, we will continue to have these kinds of accidents.
The Port of Longview heard a presentation from a liquefied natural gas company at its meeting this week. The company pushed the Board of Commissioners of the port to approve their proposed liquefied natural gas and crude oil terminal. The company had previously sought to build an $800 million micro-refinery in Longview to supply renewable fuels to the region. The Ports Commission recommended in May that the staffers work with the company, Waterside Energy, to further negotiate key deal points on the Riverside Refinery Project. According to the commission head, the port authorities were excited that the company showed such an interest in the region. Though the commission has not yet approved or denied the company's proposal, the statements by the commissioners seem to indicate support for the project, despite widespread community opposition.
This week, a teenager from Texas, 18-year-old Perry Alagapan, devised a cost-effective solution for the e-waste problem that comes from massive electronics-producing countries like China and India. These countries are trying to safeguard drinking water from e-waste in recycling factories with technologies such as chlorination, distillation, boiling, and high-tech filtration, which are expensive and reliant on fossil fuels. The new filter, which costs around $20, and which is 5 times more cost-effective, is a reliable heavy metal filter that removes 99% of the heavy metals from the water that passes through it, and is built from graphene nanotubes and can be rinsed with a vinegar concentrate. The highly concentrated waste can then be evaporated, leaving only the heavy metals, which can be used in other applications. Quote, I became interested in water purification when I visited my grandparents in India and saw with my own eyes how electronic waste severely contaminated the environment, end quote, said Alagapan, who was awarded the Stockholm Junior Water Prize at World Water Week.
You're listening to the KABU Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for media analysis on the week's top headlines from Counterspin. This will be followed by Bread and Roses at 6. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. This weekend's weather in the Portland area will be dry and breezy, just a 10% chance of rain tomorrow, with a high of 72. Sunday will be about the same. And on Labor Day this Monday, a warm, clear day is expected with a high of 76. Today in history, on September 4th, 1957, the governor of Arkansas ordered the National Guard to prevent black students from entering Central High School in Little Rock. In doing so, the governor violated a federal order to integrate the previously all-white high school. His action created a national crisis with President Dwight D. Eisenhower, finally ordering federal troops to Little Rock to ensure the judge's order was obeyed. The quote of the day is from a statement of the Little Rock Chamber of Commerce in response to the order to desegregate the schools. The statement said in part, "The Brown versus Board of Education decision of the Supreme Court of the United States, however much we dislike it, is the declared law and is binding upon us."
It's 5:15, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Well, I did not expect this. The National Republican Party has published an official policy document showing that the GOP really might be more than a gaggle of serve-the-rich plutocrats and wacky, trumped-up right-wingers. Just when you thought the party was consuming itself in the know-nothingism of its presidential pretenders and the recalcitrant do-nothingism of its Congress critters, out comes a sign of sanity. In this 18-page manifesto, the party proclaims that, quote, "our government was created by the people for all the people, and it must serve no less a purpose." All the people. Forget pontifications by Wall Street billionaires dividing America into virtuous creators, like themselves, and worthless moochers, like you and me. This document abounds with commitments to the common good. Quote, "America does not prosper," it proudly proclaims on page 3. "Unless all Americans prosper." Wow, that's downright democratic. And how's this for a complete turnaround? Labor is the United States. The men and women who, with their minds, their hearts, and hands, create the wealth that is shared in this country, they are America. Holy Koch brothers, share the wealth? Yes, and how about this? The protection of the right of workers to organize into unions and to bargain collectively is the firm and permanent policy of the Republican Party. Eat your heart out, Scott Walker, and you other labor-bashing GOP governors. The document also supports our public postal service, the United Nations, equal rights for women, expanding our national parks, vigorous enforcement of antitrust laws, and raising the minimum wage. New enlightenment in the grand old party. Hallelujah! This is Jim Hightower saying, can all this be true? Believe it or not, yes it is, except it's not new. This document is the Republican Party platform of 1956.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's populist take on what the powers that be are up to. Find out more at hightowerlowdown.org.
A third Facebook data center will be built in Prineville, Oregon. This will be the biggest such center in Oregon at nearly 500,000 square feet. It will be filled with computers and electrical equipment, but not much staff. Though intending to expand its payroll very little, Facebook will continue to have other financial impacts on the town of 9,000. Between taxes and franchise fees, it contributes about 12% of the city's income. Rural Oregon became an increasingly popular place to site data centers when state lawmakers voted last winter to exempt them from a tax levied on the value of their company's corporate brands. Tax breaks have brought Facebook and Apple to Prineville, Google to the Dalles, and Amazon to Morrow County. Each firm is now involved in a data center building boom. In exchange for the tax breaks, companies are obligated to make some concessions. Facebook, for example, must pay employees 150% of Crook County's average salary. The recession of 2008 hit Crook County in thinly populated eastern Oregon especially hard, pushing the jobless rate above 17%. It's now down to 8.6%. The Crook County seat of Prineville was a fading mill town that lost lumber jobs and a Les Schwab corporate headquarters before Facebook and Apple came. Because data centers can be located anywhere, high-tech giants determined to win favorable tax deals exert tremendous leverage when negotiating with small communities. Typical for such facilities, Facebook's newest data center will be exempt from property taxes.
And now, in honor of Labor Day this Monday, we go to Today in Labor History, a radio segment designed to educate and inform workers about the struggles of the past.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1991. 3,500 buses rolled into Washington, D.C. They were loaded with protesters there to participate in Solidarity Day. The AFL-CIO organized the event to coincide with the Labor Day weekend. They issued a statement, Why We March, outlining labor's demands. The purpose of the day was to bring attention to the concerns of the nation's working people, especially over health care. Other reasons for the march included a call for more public works programs. Another major demand was the end to permanent replacement of striking workers by scabs. Bernie Dinkin, Secretary Treasurer of the Amalgamated Clothing and Textile Workers Union in Philadelphia, explained, One of the main purposes for us going down is to let our friends know, our friends in the Democratic Party who are sitting on their laurels, that if they do not support anti-scab legislation, we will vote against them, no matter what they've done in the past. The most important aim of the event was to show worker strength and solidarity. A similar showing of solidarity had taken place in the nation's capital 10 years before. After President Reagan fired striking air traffic controllers, a September 1981 rally had drawn more than 250,000 people. The 1991 action brought out similar numbers. Despite the 95-degree weather, tens of thousands converged on the nation's capital. They came from across the nation and 30 countries. 100 buses and a specially chartered train made the trip from Philadelphia. Noticeable among the crowd were members of the United Steelworkers Union with their gold and blue shirts. 180 different labor, religious, and civil rights groups stood up on that day for the rights of working people. Labor History in Two brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com.
And now we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. Steelmaker ATI and the United Steelworkers Union will meet again September 11th in an effort to negotiate an end to the company's lockout of 2,200 workers. The union says so far ATI hasn't said whether it plans to change its last offer made June 30th. The USW says that ATI is demanding unfair concessions and that slowed down the pace of bargaining this summer. ATI says the scheduled September 11th bargaining session with the USW is a positive step forward. As Verizon continues to demand concessions from 39,000 CWA and IBEW workers, the company has fired Verizon Wireless CWA Local 1109 union activist Bianca Cunningham. The union says she was fired for union activity, and they consider it a frontal attack against the union. A rally September 10th at the Verizon store where she used to work, 86th Street between 21st Avenue and Bay Parkway in Brooklyn, will demand her reinstatement. IBEW's Miles Calvey says the hugely profitable Verizon is making billions using offshore workers and accounts while trying to wring concessions from American workers.
This incredible amount of offshore, both money they have in accounts and jobs that they have. They have service centers in India and Manila and Tijuana, Mexico, that could very easily be in America. They choose not to do it because it just allows them to make even more money.
Illinois unions can thank one Democrat who failed to show up for the failure of the Illinois House to override the veto of some legislation that would let an arbitrator decide labor contracts if unions and the governor can't reach an agreement. Representative Ken Duncan of Chicago failed to show up
for that veto override vote. Illinois House Speaker Michael Madigan says he had lined up the exact number of votes needed to override the veto of anti-union Governor Bruce Rauner. But Duncan's failure to show up handed Rauner a veto victory on the legislation that was backed by Illinois unions. The Seattle Education Association is taking a strike vote after talks with the school district ended without a new labor agreement. School starts September 9th in Seattle. 5,000 educators are represented by the Seattle Education Association. The union says the teachers and the school district are still way apart on the key issues, including pay. Seattle teachers and their supporters picketed 9 schools on Wednesday after talks ended Tuesday with no new labor deal.
Workers Independent News is proud to be heard on The Union Edge, Labor's Talk Radio. Live nationwide weekdays, noon to 3 p.m. at theunionedge.com.
Workers Independent News is made possible in part through underwriting support from the National Association of Letter Carriers and from the OPEIU, the Office and Professional Employees International Union. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Thursday's announcement from the United States Department of Justice to require warrants to be obtained prior to the use of cell site simulators doesn't go far enough to satisfy concerns from privacy and civil liberties advocates. The change will require law enforcement agents at the federal level to obtain a search warrant prior to using the devices, which are marketed under the brand name of Stingray and made by the Harris Corporation. The DOJ's new policy has a pair of exemptions for exigent and exceptional circumstances, which, according to the Electronic Frontier Foundation, or EFF, are undefined. What privacy advocates would like to have seen more of involves extending the warrant requirements to all state and local law enforcement agencies as well, and not to be limited to just those bureaus working in conjunction with a federal investigation. Legal documents regarding a case against the state of Florida from 2013 contain the police department's explanation for failing to obtain a warrant, saying that it was due to a non-disclosure agreement between the department and device maker Harris Corporation. Harris received more than $4 million in publicly funded subsidies in Florida during the fiscal years 2011 and 2012.
And now, the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine, from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
The United Nations Conference on Trade and Development Agency said this week that living conditions in the Gaza Strip are so bad that they have been described as, quote, less than humane, unquote, and potentially uninhabitable by 2020. In addition to severe crises linked to water and electricity shortages, the UN agency says that Gaza's 1.8 million residents have yet to recover from the destruction of last year's Israeli offensive, which claimed the lives of more than 2,100 Palestinians in 51 days between July 8th and August 28th. The UN agency said in a report into the Palestinian economy in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, published this week, that 3 Israeli wars against Gaza in 6 years and 8 years of economic blockade have been blamed for terrible living conditions in the coastal enclave. Despite claims of an internationally sponsored reconstruction process, UNCTAD experts also warn that development in the Gaza Strip is not merely hindered, but reversed. In the year 2000, 72,000 people depended on food aid, but now the number has risen to almost 1 million, in a clear sign of the deteriorating conditions on the ground. In the meantime, Israeli media sources said the government is looking into easing restrictions of the rules of engagement of the Israeli military, which will give the soldiers free hand to open fire at Palestinian stone throwers. The statement appeared to be a response to recent calls by hawkish cabinet ministers and Jewish settler leaders to crack down on Palestinian protests. The Israeli army says such incidents have increased in recent weeks since a Palestinian toddler and his father were burned to death when their house was firebombed in late July by Israeli settlers in the village of Douma near Nablus. Local observers say the term itself is misleading, as Israeli soldiers already have free hand to shoot at stone throwers, which explains the high number of deaths among young Palestinians. Defense for Children International Palestine chapter said 1,800 children were killed across the occupied Palestinian territories by Israeli military since 2000, with an average of one child every 3 days. In other news, the Palestinian leadership has confirmed that the Palestinian National Council, the highest legislative authority of the Palestinian people, is set to meet on the 14th and the 15th of this month in Ramallah. The Council will discuss the report of the Executive Committee of the Palestinian Liberation Organization in light of the stalemate of the peace process and will elect new members for the Executive Committee after 11 out of 18 members submitted their resignation, including the Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas, who is also the chairman of the committee. For IMEMC News, this is George Rishmawi.
Listening to the KABU Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Robin Ryan, Martin Dodge, Kristen Yount, and Ryan Fritcher. Our engineer is Liam Delta. The KABU Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews or look for us on Twitter at KABU News. You're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River 91.9 FM. I'm Linda Olson-Osterland.
And I'm Martin Dodge. Coming up on Monday morning on KABU, it's at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodwin and Juan Gonzalez.